Welcome, everybody, to concurrent session, whatever it's called. 8C. Sorry. Welcome to 8C. For those who don't know me, my name is Kevin O'Sullivan. I'm a former consulting actuary. I'm now the CEO of UniSuper, have been for the last 5 years. And we have a session today to talk about metrics for retirement income. And we have a wonderful team of Nick, Hadass, and Tom. And I'll give you a bit of a bio on each of those three. I've got a lot to say about each of them, but I'll do an abridged version. So Nick, many of you I'm sure know Nick. He's the head of the retirement solutions for Willis Towers Watson Australia and a senior member of the firm's Australian business. He manages key relationships and provides strategic advice to some of Willis Towers Watson Australia's largest clients. Nick has been with Willis Towers Watson for over 20 years. Nick's a regular speaker at conferences and seminars in Australia and globally on risk, retirement, investment, and longevity-related issues. And he's the author of a number of papers on these topics. He's a qualified actuary, a member of the Association of Superfunds of Australia's Super System Design Policy Council, and an adjunct fellow of Macquarie University's Applied Finance Centre. Tom Sneddon. Tom joined Willis Towers Watson in 2016 as an actuarial analyst, primarily providing advice to super trustees and corporate clients. He's a member of the Retirement Solutions team, performing retirement income projections and estimates, as well as software development for retirement income product and strategy solutions. Tom has 6 years' experience, having been part of the CSIRO Monash Superannuation Research Cluster prior to joining Willis Towers Watson. And he's a member of the Actuaries Institute's Superannuation Projection Disclosure Subcommittee. And last but not least is Hadass Danziger. Hadass is an integral member of the consulting team at Willis Towers Watson, providing actuarial advice on a wide range of projects for superannuation funds, including benefit design, benefit harmonization, IAS 19, and U.S. GAAP accounting and actuarial valuations. She's a core member of the post-retirement solutions team, providing her valuable technical skills in post-retirement products, research, and fund strategy advice. Hadass has over 11 years' experience in the retirement industry and has worked with a range of clients, including manufacturing, transport, and engineering companies, working with both corporate funds and master trusts. Hadass has also worked with various industry funds and life insurance providers. So we have a group of three joining us today, or going to present to us today. Nick's, I think, going to start us off, but he's going to present. He's going to get the team to do a lot of the talking today. So I'll sit down and take it away.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So this is a technical paper. There is a paper on the website, or on the app at least, and I think we'll be on the website on this topic. So I'm going to stand and just give you a bit of context. You know, why did we write this paper and what is this session about? Because it is a little bit unusual, I think. What we're writing and talking about today is not the question of, you know, what is the right retirement product for an individual or a cohort. We spend a lot of time doing that sort of work, as do a number of others in the industry. And it's really important work, and there's all the broader conversation around that with SIPPers. And we're very much interested in all of that. But what we've sort of done with this paper is to step back and say, how do we actually measure? How do we actually measure retirement products which are quite different against each other in a way that is fair, that makes sense, and ultimately can be understood by others, by our clients, and potentially by retirees themselves? And that's a question that we've spent a lot of time thinking about over many years. And the trigger for this in many ways was the fact that we'd been using various metrics. And then a couple of years ago, some of you will be aware that the team at Mine Super, now called David Bell and his team, came up with the MDUF utility function, which we'll be covering in this paper. And that caused us to think, okay, so what? There's a metric. It's a sophisticated metric. We'll be looking at how that works. We've got a range of other ones we've used. How do these all stack up? How do they actually compare? You know, is there, quote-unquote, the best or silver bullet of metrics? So that's our focus. So as we go through today, I'd ask you to remember, we're not actually we're looking at retirement products, but we're using them as illustrations of how we actually understand better these metrics that that are available. Some of which you'll be familiar with, some may be new. So it is a technical paper. We think that's a good thing because we think this industry is really, or this area rather, is really growing in importance, as we all know. And so it's really important that it has a solid technical base, and actuaries have got an important role to play in making sure that we use metrics that are understood and that are valid. So a little more motivation for this, just to set it up. I think we need metrics in particular because there's a lot of, emotion almost attached to some of the questions of, what the right products are. And I think we heard a bit of that yesterday and in the press. This whole topic of SIPPers is a big one. People bring preconceived ideas about whether product A is better than product B for certain types of members. And these quotes, they're not genuine quotes, but they're the sort of things that you do see around. And there's a, let's be honest, there's a commercial aspect to this this question as well, as to which product is best. So I would argue that whatever you think of these statements, there's just a bit of a mismatch in what they are effectively using to measure the performance of various products. So if we take the first one, annuities don't return enough to fund a full retirement. Straight away, with our sort of metrics hat on, I'm thinking, well, hang on, that's a misapplication of a metric. It's using an expected return metric to form a judgment on an annuity, which at the end of the day is not a investment product, or the way I see it, it's a risk management product. So in the wider world, I think metrics are not well applied, not well understood, and so, again, we need to sort of shore up the base. Let's have a look at this, and we made this as simple as we could. Let's say you arrived from Mars and you were presented with two patterns of retirement income. You didn't know anything about account-based pension or annuities or anything else. You were just presented with these two patterns of income and asked, either for yourself or for your members, what's the best, which one would you prefer? Now, unfair question, but let's say you're asked it anyhow. You start thinking about that in that case, and you start seeing those two patterns and say, well, okay, the left-hand one might deliver a higher income than the right-hand, but it might deliver a lower one. So that needs to be taken into account. The left-hand one gives me a variable income. It's not constant. The right-hand one does. So that might be a preference that I have to take into account. And thirdly, the left-hand one apparently can run out, whereas, again, apparently, unless you live beyond 100, the right-hand one looks like it doesn't. So straight away, here are the questions that you need to ask, and you can see already that's asking you to take into account things that go way beyond, what's the expected return on a product. So, apologies if this is all just telling you, I think this audience, this is telling you what you already know, but it sort of is back to basics this, because we are sort of advocating that we need to go beyond the sort of metrics that are out there and commonly thought about. So what we've tried to do, just to paint the picture, as I say, there's a paper. If you're interested, please read it. I gather some of you won't have had a chance. So there's more detail in the paper. What we've tried to do here is to, first of all, identify 8 metrics you can use for this sort of work. We then classified them, and I can tell you that wasn't a simple task. They're difficult beasts to classify, but we did it nonetheless. And we classified them into entry level, what we call proportion measures, and then utility based measures. Now, bear with us with this. There's a bit of overlap, so just we're doing the road test categorisation, and so we need some categories. What we'll then do is go and evaluate each of these against some sample retirement products, try and show what sort of outcomes they produce, and then finally we're going to, or in each category, we're going to come up with a best in class. Now again, bear with us, this is not a precise science, and we're not seriously saying that none of those have or are clearly better than the others, but we wanted to sort of set ourselves that task of saying, all right, which one do we think sort of works the best within each category. Now, a couple of factors that we can use to sort of distinguish measures is whether or not it allows for what we call a target income. So this is the concept of, if your retirement strategy has a target, if you define a target, you want to earn $40,000 per annum given an amount of income up front, does the metric actually test against that? And we'll be going through and seeing, or as you can see there, some of them do have that anchor, if you like, and test against a given standard of living. Others don't. That's not to say one is better than the other. These are horses for courses, but that's a distinguishing feature. The other is whether it allows for residual. Some metrics just look at what income a strategy produces. Others bring in the concept of, does it leave a bequest or residual as well. So we'll talk more about those aspects, but I'm now going to hand over to the team here. Briefly, I'll just show you, though, what the strategies we have chosen to evaluate against, so when you see those popping up, you know what we mean. They're fairly self-explanatory, and again, we've had to simplify things. We know there's a whole bunch of other ones that you could allow for. We've got two account-based pensions, one where you're drawing a target income, the other where you're drawing at the minimum drawdown rates. We've got 50-50, an account-based pension and a lifetime annuity, and then 100% lifetime annuity. And most of you would be familiar with the sort of spreads that you can see around there of the incomes that those produce. So let's have a look at our first class, which we're calling entry level, Tom.
Hi, everyone. I'll start off by going back to basics, as Nick was mentioning. I'll display the different entry level metrics. We've got three of them. These are metrics which are simple numbers, easy to use and understand, and hopefully easy to explain. So our first metric is ruin-based metrics, probability and age of ruin. The concept of ruin, as most of you probably already know, refers to exhaustion of a retiree's liquid sources of income during retirement. For strategies which include an account-based pension, such as Scenario 1, ruin occurs when the account-based pension balance reaches zero and is no longer able to be drawn upon. This occurs just when the purple area starts. For strategies involving pure annuities, this is throughout the entirety of retirement. We have two main metrics for this area. We have the probability of ruin, which is the likelihood that a retiree's liquid assets run out while they're alive or before some particular age that we choose. We also have the age at ruin, which is the distribution of ages at which the liquid assets run out when we project them to test some strategy. The strengths of these metrics are that they work really well for fully liquid strategies, such as the account-based pension example, where ruin occurs when the account-based pension runs out and the retiree is solely reliant upon the age pension, which is effectively the end of their strategic time. The weakness of these metrics is that they're of little value for strategies which include a non-liquid portion, such as the lifetime annuity, which is our extreme example, where ruin is immediate upon retirement. This fails to recognise that the retiree still has a retirement income source even after account-based pension ruin. Another weakness of these metrics is they don't give us any information about the adequacy of income, only whether or not liquid income is available. This adequacy aspect will be covered in our next metric. Our next metric is the probability of inadequacy. In this context, inadequacy is the point at which a strategy's income falls below some adequate level that we've defined beforehand. This can be, but isn't always at ruin. The probability of inadequacy is our main metric in this area. This is the likelihood that a strategy's income falls below the adequate level while the retiree is alive or by some particular time. For our ABP strategy on the left, inadequacy and ruin are at the exact same time, because as soon as the account-based pension runs out, we hit zero. For scenario two, inadequacy occurs at a different time from ruin. We're not ruined in this context if it's an account-based pension, but we're inadequate when it falls below the adequacy level. The strengths of this metric is that it's a bit stronger than the probability of ruin and age of ruin metrics in directly addressing whether the income from a strategy is adequate or not, not just focusing on whether or not ruin occurs as a be-all and end-all. Therefore, it's applicable for all kinds of retirement strategies, not just account-based pension strategies. The weakness, though, is that, as with ruin, it fails to measure the size of any income shortfalls once we hit inadequacy, only whether or not an inadequate event has occurred. This will be covered in the next metric. Our third metric, duration and depth of income misses, is a more balanced approach to income adequacy. Here, it's broken into two parts. There's the duration of income misses, which is the number of years in retirement where the income is below some target level. So, for example, on the left, it's 8, and on the right, it's 4. Similarly, the depth of income misses provides the average amount by which the income falls short of the target level in the years when it does fall short. So, for example, for scenario 1, that would be, say, 0.5, and for scenario 2, that would be 1. In both these examples, the total shortfall is identical. So duration and depth of income misses is useful for a retiree to judge whether they can cope with either 4 really bad years or 8 slightly poor years. We're now going to compare our different products to show some of the aspects of these different metrics. So under the ruin metrics, our highest ranking strategy is the minimum drawdown account-based pension, which by definition never reaches ruin, as the drawdown is a percentage of balance. But at the same time, this strategy also always falls below target income. Our lowest ranking strategy is the 100% lifetime annuity, which by definition as well also it ruins immediately. But this doesn't tell us anything about the income that's provided. The insight we can gain from looking at this, about this metric, is that really it only cares about liquid asset balance. It doesn't really care about the size of the income. This is covered by the next metric. Our comparison on the basis of the probability of inadequacy metric, which cares about income adequacy rather than just liquid assets. On this metric, our highest ranking strategy is the 100% lifetime annuity, which was our worst strategy on the previous metric. This is because it always provides us with adequate income because of the pricing that we've used, but it doesn't tell us the income of this one relative to other strategies, only that it's always adequate. The lowest ranking strategy on this basis is the minimum drawdown account-based pension, which was our best strategy on the first metric. This is because it usually provides inadequate income with a minimum drawdown rate and subject to the investment markets because it's exposed to them as an account-based pension. This doesn't tell us anything, though, about the income in the other years when there wasn't inadequacy, only that at some point, in the majority of cases, at some point, it provided inadequate income. What we can learn about the metric from these comparisons is that the metric only cares about about adequacy as a yes or no question, whether or not there was inadequacy at any time. It doesn't tell us anything about the levels of income in the other years or anything when the adequacy is intermittent. For the duration and depth of income misses, this metric shows two aspects of income adequacy: how close we were to target income when the target was missed in a strategy, and how often the target income was missed throughout the time period. The highest ranking strategy on this metric is again the 100% lifetime annuity, which has many small shortfalls regardless of investment experience. And the lowest ranking metric is the account-based pension with a target income, which has fewer shortfalls, but when they occur, they are much larger. The other two strategies fall somewhere in between. So if we look overall at a total comparison of the different metrics, we've judged that the best in class for this category is the depth and duration of income misses. This is the only metric that shows the trade-off of frequency versus severity of shortfalls. It lets the retiree decide, do they want frequent, small, non-volatile shortfalls, as in the 100% lifetime annuity? Do they want fewer shortfalls, but there will be large downside risk, as in the account-based pension with target income? Or do they prefer consistent moderate shortfalls, as in the minimum drawdown ABP, or fewer but slightly larger shortfalls, as in ABP annuity mix? This is a question that can only be assessed using this metric, whereas the other two are very blunt instruments. Therefore, the duration and depth of income misses is the strongest metric in this area. The one issue with this metric is that it doesn't tell us much about the size and number of shortfalls together, and whether or not a particular strategy, various strategies provide value for money. These will be covered by metrics which Hadass will discuss.
Thanks, Tom. Bring this down a bit. Hi, everyone. So the next category of metrics that I'm going to cover is what we've called proportion measures. And there's no exact science behind this category name. It's essentially that we're talking about metrics that we've expressed in some percentage form. So the first of these metrics is probably very familiar to us actuaries. It's a net present value. The way we've tried to scale this net present value is by creating a metric called money's worth, which takes the present value and divides it by the initial balance that we got at the start. What we've also tried to capture here is not just the income that a strategy generates, but also in each future point in time or possible time horizon, we look at the availability of a liquid balance or a bequest. So if we look at this illustration, our, say, account-based pension on the left has the opportunity for income growing in each time horizon, but at each point in time also offers this liquid balance. Whereas on the right with our, say, lifetime annuity, the value that we see coming from the product is for the longer lifetimes. So that's often what we hear out in the market. It's like, well, I'm only really going to get my value for money out of an annuity if I live longer than expected. So this is what this metric is trying to capture. And it's an intuitive metric. It's simple for people to understand. But what it doesn't include is this element of target income that we've been discussing. So we try to address this with the next metric. Desired income attainability. It's probably as clear as its name. It's whether or not we were able to attain the income that we desired. And it's a simple average. It's just looking at the total income, the average income that we did receive over the cumulative target incomes that we wanted to receive. So again, that's quite an intuitive measure. The downside of it is that it includes both the upsides and the downsides of the shortfall. So if we look at our illustrative example on the right, in the years where we have actually achieved greater than target, in the metric, those will probably muddy the waters with the times where we fell short. So we try to address that with our next metric. The Goodness of Fit Index, or as we like to call in our team, GOFI. So this is a metric that Nick and the post-retirement team have discussed and developed over a number of years, so we are quite partial to it. And what it's trying to express is sort of like a line of best fit. because we are looking at the squared shortfalls over the squared targets. Now, the actual formula for GOFI is quite complex and quite involved. So as Nick said, the paper is available and we go through all of the formulas in detail. But if we look at our scenario here, here we have two income patterns that generate the exact same amount of income and also display the exact amount of shortfall. But they just show it in slightly different patterns. And so again, it goes to the question of, well, which do you prefer? In this case, GOFI penalizes the strategy that has the larger shortfalls, even over the shorter periods of time. So it will favor scenario one, in this case, over scenario two, as we can see by the bottom of that table that the GOFI is higher for scenario one. So what this is trying to show is sort of like an implied risk aversion. It's forming a view of the preferences of retirees in a way, saying that they would prefer smaller shortfalls over a longer period over larger shortfalls over a shorter period. So getting into our results and looking at the rankings, so we'll see NPV of lifetime income and money's worth, which is just the scaled version. They're going to give us the same rankings. So they've ranked in median outcomes when we expect markets to perform as usual. The minimum drawdown strategy is ranked the highest, and that's likely because it's actually been able to provide an income in every year. It was never exhausted just by virtue of how it's been designed that you, as Tom mentioned, you just draw a percentage each year. In this case, the 100% lifetime annuity strategy is ranked the lowest, and that is possibly a function of the current pricing, that it's not considered value for money in current markets, but also because we placed this bequest inside the present value, and there was some importance in that bequest which that strategy doesn't deliver. If we look at our desired income attainability metric, so we see that the minimum drawdown in this case is the lowest rank, and that's because its design didn't allow for any targeting of income. So although it is never exhausted, it's at the expense of never actually meeting the criteria that you placed upon it. In median outcomes for this metric, the combination of 50% of lifetime annuity and 50% account-based pension fared very well, and that was because of the protection that the lifetime annuity provides, and because of the way we build up our target income approach. So we start with our product and whatever age pension we were eligible for, and then we drew the balance from our account-based pension to fill out to our target income. So the presence of the annuity has meant we could stretch out how long our account balance lasts for and how long we can achieve target. This is more apparent in the fifth percentile outcomes when we might experience adverse markets, that the protection from the lifetime annuity is very highly valued in this case. We see that the rankings for the goodness of fit are almost exactly the same as the desired income attainability. And that's because of our design, where we didn't really allow our income to go above our target, except for the case of minimum drawdown. So that's why you'd see the numbers are largely similar. If we had varied income above target, that's where we would see GOFI penalising the shortfalls, whereas the desired income attainability might have been a little less softened by all of the upsides. So our best in class, admittedly somewhat biased, is our GOFI measure, because we feel that it incorporates our element of target income. It starts to introduce the concept of utility and forming a view about the preferences that we feel our retirees might have. And it also has this benefit of being a nice scaled number that sits between 0 and 1. But what it doesn't have, and admittedly so, is reference to some sort of bequest motive. And it doesn't have an actual explicit utility function. So that's where I'll hand over to Nick to discuss our next set of metrics.
So this section has some pretty simple concepts, but the scariest formulas. I about half an hour before the session, I suggested I'd bounce this back to my colleagues here, and they looked at me like I was from Mars. I said, no way. So I'm going to give it a go. So bear with me when we get to those. I think utility we're all familiar with. And in this part of the presentation, or the paper rather, we haven't tried to actually go wider than the MDUF utility function. Our view is that when you start talking utility, and anyone who's familiar with that work will know that that was a very comprehensive piece of work, looked widely over all the academic literature and industry usage. So, you know, that's, if that was a retail product, that'd be a category killer. Like, that is it. So it's a little bit different the way we look at it here. We're not trying to look at alternatives to MDUF, but if you understand the MDUF framework, there are actually a number of metrics within that that you can use. And so what we turned our mind to instead was, all right, well, what actually works, particularly with an eye to sort of presenting this to clients, what actually works best within that framework to actually use as a metric? And so I guess in the interest of time, I'm going to assume we all know what the concept of utility is. This is the MDUF formula, so not invented by us, but you know, I think is an industry standard when you're talking utility functions. The key things, and you know, I would never put this up at any other conference other than Actuaries Conference. I think we can all sort of cope with that up to a point. Just to sort of simplify it a bit, and I certainly need this sort of, just right, what am I meant to think about that? Just think of it this way. It's got an income component. So the first bit is the income utility. And the next bit is the bequest utility. And so, you know, in setting this up, you have a certain preference or risk aversion which governs how much you want to see that income vary. And you've also got this phi in the brackets here in the second term. That's your bequest motive. How much do you prefer income later to actually consuming income now? So it's a measure of sort of how prepared are you to defer income to save for a rainy day or for bequest. So think of it as having those two parts. The main point we want to cover here, and obviously this is a massive topic, but just to fit it into the structure that we've got here, we actually identified two metrics that fall out of the MDUF structure that we think are worth considering. The first is something called MDUF score. Now, why are we using this and not just the utility itself? The utility scores, if any of you have looked at this, give you really strange numbers. You get sort of the utility of a given strategy is negative 1 times 10 to the negative 24 sort of thing, and you think, A, what am I meant to make of that, and B, do my clients even know what e to the neg 24 is? It's just not a useful measure, not friendly at all. Neither is this formula, by the way, but the key point that I'll sort of jump to, or first contrast, and then I'll jump to the results rather than dwelling on the formulas, is we have an MDUF score and an alternative measure called risk-adjusted income. And we think these are the two measures that are the best within the sort of family of MDUF to use. And I'll show you why and we'll talk a bit about what they represent. Sorry, I'm jumping forward and we can come back to those if time permits. Risk-adjusted income and MDUF score both arise from, if you like, inverting that utility formula I showed you. So rather than saying, here's the utility for a particular strategy, risk-adjusted income says what level of income as a constant delivers me the same utility as the income component of that strategy. So you think, I mean, I sort of think of, if you've got a bumpy line with those sort of fan charts we saw before, that's the strategy you're evaluating. Risk-adjusted income says, all right, tell me the utility of that, and then say, what's the annuity income, if you like, that delivers the same amount of utility on a lifetime basis? That's it. So, I mean, I think you can sort of convey that in sort of fairly high-level terms. The nice thing about that metric is that it represents an income, so you can actually relate it back to the strategy you're talking about. Bear in mind, we're talking about strategies here which came from a $450,000 upfront investment. So, you know, $30,000-$40,000 is the right sort of income for life that you'd be expecting to deliver. And so this measure now allows you to say which of those is higher. The higher one is actually the one that delivers you the best outcome on a utility basis. Now, if we look at the ranking there, you'll see in particular that the 100% lifetime annuity is the one that wins. And that the reason for that is that one feature of this metric is that it gives no weight to bequest. If we look at MDUF score, that's a similar metric. It's not as intuitive because you see those incomes, they don't mean anything. You cannot relate them back to a real-life income. It's purely an adjustment measure. And you can see in terms of winners and losers, the annuity now comes last because this measure, unlike the previous one, has a bequest motive built in. So there's swings and roundabouts. I have a sort of a personal liking for risk-adjusted income, but after vigorous debate internally, we decided best in class was actually the MDUF score, mainly because it's got that bequest motive built in. And as we know, I mean, there's a contentious issue, but bequest motive, allowing for that within strategies, is a pretty important factor in a lot of cases. Not necessarily in all, but in a number of cases. So the extra flexibility you get there, I think, gives us gives the prize to MDUF score. We'll quickly go on to, we've chosen best in class. We're now, the grand finale is putting them alongside each other. A few brief comments from Hadass.
Thanks, Nick. So really what we've attempted to do here is just bring together our three best-in-classes, the depth and duration pairing, the GoFee, and our MDUF score with our bequest motive, and show how each of them ranks the products or the strategies that we modelled. And really the picture here is that there's no clear winner. It doesn't tell you what to pick, which is exactly the point, that with metrics, you might need to look at them in combination, and it will all very much depend on the preferences of the retiree that you're looking at or the cohort of retirees that you're looking at. And even within that, if we look at our first two metrics, first two best in class, they're target income based. So they're going to be very sensitive to the target income that you choose. Similarly, for the MDUF score, the parameter phi that we said was our bequest motive parameter will be sensitive to what the preference is for a bequest motive. So there are so many levers that can be pulled and so many ways that these metrics can be viewed. So there is no silver bullet, I guess, was the conclusion that we came to. So, Nick, if you wanted to put it into the context of SIPPers and all of the research that's out there. Yep.
So just final comments. Thanks at us. We didn't have time for this, but so where have we got to with all this? A lot of numbers and concepts we've thrown at you. We'll continue to use all of these, or some of these, in individual projects as the circumstances requires. We don't think there's a dominant metric. We do like the MDUF, and we think that once trustees or clients get their head around the concept of utility, there's a lot to say about that, but there is room for these simpler metrics as well, I think, certainly to introduce it. So it's a combination rather than a single category killer. Does it resonate with your audience? That's always a key one, and that's hence my comment on that risk-adjusted income. I like to be able to say, think of it as here's an income that represents that target, that strategy that you're testing. Just a sort of sideline to that, in the recent discussion on SIPPers, there's been mention that governments may try, as they advance this program, to come up with a comparable metric for retirement products. I think that was mentioned when they announced the next wave of this. I think they've gone a bit quiet on that in the recent paper, but I think they'd be looking for something like that as this progresses. In a bit way, there's the standard risk measure on for investment during the accumulation phase. So this is only going to be more topical, I think, is how do we actually represent strategies well. And our third learning there was just that exploring the tail is important. So whatever metric you come up with, make sure
you stress it and say, what, how does it look when markets are bad? And in the terms of the SIPA debate, it's particularly important because I think there's more obligation on a trustee if they're sort of, in a sense, soft defaulting someone into a strategy to be aware of how it performs in bad markets. And so testing the tail value of any metric you use is particularly important. We'll leave it there and to give us time for questions, just to mention so we don't miss out at the end, the paper is available, or which will be available. I believe it's on the app already, but it will be available on the website for you to download and read, and happy to talk about. But we'll go for questions now.
We will go for questions now. So, John, do you want to walk up to the mic? Thank you. So we've got a mic just in the middle of the room there.
Thank you for a very interesting session. Two questions. One, the comparison between account-based pensions and lifetime annuities, wouldn't that depend quite importantly on the relative assumptions you make about both investment return for the account-based pension, but also the mortality assumptions you make that underlie the account-based pension? And my second question is, I suspect that you don't penalise the irregularity of the income from an account-based pension. If you take the SIS minimum amount, you have this rather bizarre situation where every 5 or 10 years you get this very strange increase of anything between 17% and 28%. I suspect you haven't penalised that, but I wonder whether it's worth designing a metric that, because people don't like, I can imagine that people would not like income, they're not going to care when income goes up a lot, but they are going to care when income goes down a lot. I wonder whether it's worth thinking about a metric which does respond to the variability from year to year of the apparent spending allowance.
I think so. So to answer your first question, it would definitely be sensitive to the assumptions. And in the paper, we go through the specific assumptions that we put forward. But absolutely, we even consider that our lifetime annuities in combination with an account-based pension would mean that you would consider a different allocation for the account-based pension when it's combined than when it's separate, when it's alone, rather. So that's why just our discussion mostly focused on the metrics rather than the products. And we could have modelled many different kinds of products along the spectrum, but we chose maybe just 4 intuitive ones that people recognise, knowing that there are so many variations in that way.
And to your second one, John, I agree. And in fact, when we were developing, I mean, I was involved in the MDUF advisory group, so not we didn't develop it, we just gave comment on it, but one of the discussion points there was whether you build in, I think we called it persistence, so regardless of whether income was high or low as a separate factor, does it persist year on year and give a higher score to a strategy that does. Now, I think that got eliminated just on the grounds of you can only build in so many factors and keep, it was a trade-off between simplicity. But, you know, there's certainly scope for that, and we've done some modelling in the past that has that built in. I agree, because I think, you know, predictability of outcome is a measure that has value in its own right for a lot of retirees.
Thanks for a really interesting paper and discussion. Your last slide, you said, does it resonate with the target audience? Is your target audience trustees trying to design a SIPRA, or is your target audience retirees trying to work with an advisor?
Or thirdly, advisors who are working with members?
It's a really good question. I would say initially it's targeted at trustees or advisors, but, you know, I think the direction is very clear. That last point I put up about what the government's trying to do, you know, as hard as it all this stuff is, there's pressure on all of us to make this transparent at the individual member level. And so, you know, I think that tilts the so-called right answer to this. I think that sort of aspect tilts it towards, can you explain it in 10 seconds or in a little box in a flyer? Now, that I mean, that's completely unrealistic when you think about what we've all just delved with, and our heads have been spinning with half of this stuff a lot of the time, and we've been working in it for ages. So how you could hope members to understand it, I don't know, but I think that's the direction, isn't it? I mean, they want to know why, or the government wants us to tell members why, not just say, here's your SIPA. And there's a bit of tension there, I think. I'm not sure it fully makes sense, but I just think that's the way it's heading.
To be honest, a lot of that went over my head, but just sort of one thought. These products have been going for like 20 or 30 years, and so has there been any analysis actually done that someone maybe that started an allocated pension back in 1995 or whatever, maybe looking at cohorts of people and what strategies they had and what the outcomes were? Has anyone sort of done any analysis just looking back and just actually seeing what's actually happened?
I think I... Can I answer
you,
that?
You bail me, yeah.
I actually think... I shouldn't... I think, for example, Milliman's done some work on spending patterns that probably uses some of the data that you've highlighted. I think that big funds like ours would definitely have knowledge of what's happened in members' account balances and how much they've taken out over time. Has there been a study of that? I haven't heard of one.
John, have you done any work in that area?
So there's been a study on the experience of account-based pensioner drawdown rates and investment returns and the like. Yeah, so what John just said is a lot of members are drawing down just at the minimum. In our experience, roughly half of members are drawing down at the minimum, and the other half are taking... almost double the minimum. That's kind of what our experience is at UniSuper.
Hey, thanks, guys. Daniel Levy here. Just wanted to check that my take out of this is that we shouldn't have a metric without considering the members' individual circumstances and aspirations they want out of their product. Is that right?
I think that's right. One of the, you know, how would you sum this up and say what metric should you use in a particular project? I would say, just picking up the earlier point, what's your audience, be it trustees or advisors, perhaps more so the members in the first instance, what do they care about and what's their capability of understanding a concept like utility? You can't, I mean, as a consultant, I wouldn't walk into a meeting and start talking utility unless I knew that they had some, not just interest, not just understanding of it, but are they interested enough to actually travel that? Because you don't do it in one meeting. You probably have to sort of set it up. And this is exactly what I know David Bell's done at mine. That's not going to work for every fund. So I think it's taking into account what your audience wants out of the project. That's why we didn't dismiss these more simplistic measures, because they've certainly got a place. I'd be interested, Kevin, what would you say as a fund?
I was thinking earlier about John, your presentation earlier today. John, for those who weren't there, John was talking about the tax, the impact of people putting in extra money into the super and what it means to their age pension down the track. And while it's hard enough dealing with retirement income streams and MDUF, I was thinking holistically, should a super fund factor in accumulation and retirement to come up with the best utility for a member throughout the course of their life? And just think how lovely actuarially that would be. I'm not sure what I should say from a UniSuper perspective.
I was just curious about how you would see the ranking of these different measures or how useful they are in the case where the accumulated balance is clearly very different from what's needed to ensure an adequate income, whether it's much higher or much lower.
I think that's where it comes to our definitions of what we called adequacy versus target. So when we talked about adequacy, that was probably more about a minimum level for subsistence, but target would probably be related to the account balance that you had with at the start, because it would be reflective of, say, the purchasing power and the spending power you had pre-retirement. So that's where, interestingly, in our model, we calibrated our target income so that in expected outcomes for that given account balance that we started with, the retiree's income, target income, would last to age 90. So that is an approach that we try to take so that the target is calibrated to what you started with. And that's inclusive of age pension, so you factor that in as well.
Okay. Last question. Sorry, Duncan, you're going to ask one? Okay, I'll give you two.
When I did some work on the MDUF model, I found that if you had a liking for the bequest motive, that the minimum drawdown account-based pension always came out number one. Have you come across anything contrary to that?
Let's have a quick look at our results there. So you were saying...
this one.
Yeah, so the second one...
It's true.
Yeah, we agree with that conclusion. Yeah. And, of course, I mean, we don't really have time, but, you know, there's some interesting results. This, we played around with that. That fires how much you like a bequest, and so we actually did some results saying, what if you varied that as you go from left to right? That's getting a stronger and stronger bequest motive. If you don't have any bequest motive, the annuity strategies win. As you come up the chart, then they fall to last, and the other strategies win.
I think it's also a function of the assumptions that you're using at the time. Like right now, annuities are quite poorly priced.
We've tried to that's an important point that, again, in this audience, we can get into. Doing this work for a long time,
we're very aware of that. We're trying to present fairly, you know, the trade-off between an account-based strategy and an annuity. Probably it's fair to say our model, when interest rates fell and annuity prices fell, our market model probably didn't fall as quickly. So we found that when we were doing modelling in that time, you couldn't get an annuity to stack up under any measure. Now lower for longer in our market model has mean it's back to a more equal thing. But that is such an important point. I mean, if you try and compare these things with current market rates and long term equity returns, you're just never going to get any meaningful numbers.
Okay, last one, Duncan.
One comment, one question. Can you go back to that same chart that had the risk adjusted income on it?
Sorry, which one?
The risk adjusted.
Yep.
Keep going. The actual results.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that one.
Yep.
Just check I'm understanding this correctly. You're saying that that top row is sort of an equivalence measure. It's sort of, you've got it risk adjusted, but I'll say risk neutral in my balance. Is it really trying to say that compared with the minimum drawdown strategy, 100% lifetime annuity, you'd want an extra, $8,000 to compensate for the lack of bequest?
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, the other name for this is certainty equivalent income. I mean, it's that concept. It's saying just a plain level income stream with no bequest that delivers all the utility that you're searching for.
So when some of the numbers get bandied around is, well, if you take the longevity product, we'll deliver 30% more income in retirement. Does that mean that suggests that, well, it may do, but it's even that's not enough in terms of equivalence against the minimum drawdown? Is that an inference to draw?
We might have to take this offline. That 30% is not a utility based measure. Yeah, okay, but I agree with the concept. Yeah, that sort of comparison would allow you to do it, except the government's 30% was sort of raw scores.
Okay, and then just one comment to leave.
Talk to us afterwards. Right. Yeah, cool. Right. Sorry, I'm going to have to call it quits there. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thank you to Nick, Tom, and Hadass. I have some lovely chocolate to provide them, and can I ask you to fill in your forms? And thank Nick and Tom and Hadass.